I appreciate your presence here this morning. It's an encouragement to me that I may see. And let me turn this machine on, so sometimes my voice is not as strong maybe as it should be. But at any rate, I'll do the best I can this morning as we go through this. I'm not sure, I don't think that I set this thing up so that it recognizes my disk as the, we'll find out. Okay. I'd like to call to your attention this morning a recording of one of the miracles that Jesus did, and his disciples could not do it. We find this over in Matthew chapter 17, and in beginning with verse 14, and we read, "And when they had come to the multitude, a man came to him, kneeling down to him and saying, 'Lord, have mercy upon my son, for he is an epileptic and suffers severely, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. So I brought him to your disciples, but they couldn't cure him.' Then Jesus answered and said, 'O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me.' And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour." Notice in this story that a man comes to Jesus that had an epileptic son. And evidently, from reading this, it's necessary inference for us that the disciples could not cure him. They must have brought him to the disciples first, and his disciples couldn't hear him. And then Jesus answers this in a way kind of to show some displeasure in what they were not able to do. And he says, "Oh, faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? Bring him here to me." And so Jesus hears the man's request. He makes a mild rebuke to this, and then he rebukes the demon, and the child is cured from that very hour. And we continue on with the story, and we notice how the disciples reacted to this rebuke that they had received. And the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" So Jesus said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For assuredly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." That is quite a statement. If you have faith as a mustard seed, you could move this mountain. Your unbelief. So their lack of faith, their little faith, their unbelief was why they could not do this. Little faith. How big or how much is little? What is tiny or little or small? Faith as the grain of a mustard seed. Well, I don't know what a mustard seed looks like in that part of the country that they were talking about, but it says the faith of the grain of a mustard seed. And mustard seed is one of the smallest seeds, I guess, that they had around on that. But what is this trying to show to us or tell us when we read this from the scriptures? Certainly, I would say, with much assurance, that it is not to show the lack of faith on his part of his disciples. Because they have been traveling now with Jesus, and he's been doing miracles, and he's been giving them the power also to accomplish certain things. He's showed them how to do it. He's told them how to do it. He's given them this power. And yet, they don't have enough faith to do this particular one. And Jesus says they have little faith. Then he tells them how much that their little faith would be, or how much they'd had to have to cure this child. And if your faith was as big as a mustard seed, you'd be able to do this. And it's very, very small. Well, I've used this illustration to hopefully demonstrate little or small. Let me give you another illustration. And we find this over in James in chapter 3, verses 2 through 4. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits into horses' mouth that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Let's stop right there for just a moment with those two verses there. He's talking about this being we stumble in many things, and because if you can accomplish this word, or does not stumble in the word, he's a perfect man, and he's able to control the whole body. He's able to bridle the whole body. Well, bridle is also a descriptive term that's used for something that you put on a horse or an animal. And if you can do this, he says you're able to bridle the whole body. You put a bit into a horse's mouth, and you can make them obey, and we can make them turn their whole body in any direction that we want them to do. And a horse is a pretty big size animal. And yet this small bit and this bridle allows us to control them. Now, I have a little bit of personal experience with a horse and a bridle and a bit, and its improper use. One time years ago when I was a young man, we were up on top of a mountain when we were hunting with a guide and outfitter, and we had horses and had all the things that would make the hunting up there in the high country easy. And if we had spent the first night there in the camp, and the next morning it was the dark of the moon and there was nothing we could see the morning when we got up about 3:30 in the morning to eat breakfast and got everything all ready to go, and we left out of the camp. The guide was in the front, and his wife was up there too, and she was in the back. And there was three guys from Texas. There was a whole lot of other people there too, but these three guys from Texas, which one of them was me, and we were all on our horses, and we were going through there. Well, there was a little tiny, tiny stream that flowed by the camp. And rather than people stepping in it and getting it all muddy and messed up and everything, he had placed some white rocks in this stream. And so these white rocks would be where you could see it. And if you stepped in it, you didn't get your feet wet, and you didn't mess it all up. But at any rate, as we were coming out, the horse could see this, and I could see it briefly there. And so I'm sitting up on this horse like a sack of cotton or a sack of grain, and the horse comes up to this, and he puts his head down, and he looks at this. And instead of the horse stepping across this thing, the horse jumped over to the other side. Well, I don't have control of the horse. There's slack in my reins and all the rest of it. And when the horse jumped on the other side, the reins were such that he got his head down, and when he hit the ground, the rodeo started. Up in the air I went, up in the air I went, and then off the horse I went. And I was way up and up air, and this old horse was a big, big horse. As I was coming down, all I could see was maybe coming down on a log with all these old branches sticking out and me being impaled on this log. Well, that was an improper use of a bit to control a horse. Horses can be controlled. If you pull the bridle back, keep their head up, you can keep them under control. But if you give them their head, they're going to do what they want to do. And in his case, he wanted to unload. And he did. But then let's continue on here with verse 4. Look also at ships. Although they're so large and they're driven by fierce winds, they're turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. if you've watched the news and the television over the last couple of weeks, you've seen pictures of this huge, huge cruise ship that's laying over on its side, about half sunken, somewhere over in Italy. And all of these people were taken off the thing, and it's a disaster. And I'm confident that the captain of that ship, that was his living, that was his livelihood. He didn't want the bottom of that cruise ship to be ripped out so that it would sink and that he would lose his job. In fact, as they used to say in the Navy, if you run over something or you hit something on the bottom, it just ruins your whole day. It just ruins the whole day. Well, it ruined probably not only his day, but it also probably has ruined his life. Well, who in the world would want to hire a man that has so little regard for navigation that he goes close to the shore and rips the bottom out of his ship? One more illustration. Matthew 7 and 3. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? I'd like to ask for a show of hands from everybody in the audience here this morning who have not got something at one time or another in your eye. Everybody has had something in their eye. Well, most of the time it feels like a huge object with jagged edges and just everything in the world, hurtful things all over it. At one time, I can vouch for this, and I had an extremely small piece of steel that got into my right eye while I was in the Navy, and it was painful at first, and then it became extremely painful, and then it became almost unbearable. And there was no doubt that there was something wrong and something in my eye. The eye doctor at the Navy hospital, he turned out all the lights in the room in complete darkness, and he shined this real bright, powerful light into my eye. And he used some microscopic type instrument to look in my eyes, and he said, "Yep, you got a piece of steel in there." And he says, "Be very, very still, and don't move your eye, because I'm going to put an instrument in there to remove this from your eye." Well, needless to say, I was as still as I possibly could, but he picked it out. That little piece of steel was beyond small and even beyond a speck that the scripture here is talking about. Yet it was so painful for me that both of my eyes were closed with the pain. You probably don't know it, but eyes are sympathetic to each other. If you have one eye that's in pain, the other eye may feel a little bit of it, and it may close or it may not close. But if it's in severe, almost unbearable pain, both eyes will close. The other eye will be sympathetic to it, and it will close also. Well, what's the point? I want you to implicitly see the illustration of small. I want you to understand small. Therefore, this becomes an introduction to the main point of my lesson. My subject is small talk. Well, where are you going with this, Bob? Small talk is conversation that you might engage in when you first meet somebody, you meet a friend, or you're sitting around talking. How are you? How you been doing? What's been going on? On and on it goes. And this is small talk. Nothing that's earth-shaking. It's just talking. But some people have a lot of trouble with this small talk. They're not able to make small talk. And if you don't try to develop some skills in using small talk, you're not going to be an easy person to talk to. And if your case is severe in this, you may find yourself spending a lot of time by yourself. No one wants to be around you. It's cruel. It's cruel to be caught in that situation. But it's just fact. Nobody wants to be around somebody that can't talk, that can't make that small talk. But there's some small talk that you don't want to be engaged in. And what would that be? I believe we can find this in the following scriptures to shed a little bit of light on it. It's found over in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 11. This is where Paul is writing to Timothy, and he's talking about the widows, when they're to be included into the daily dole or into to be taken care of. And it begins at verse 11, "But refuse the younger widows, for when they've begun to grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry, having condemnation because they have cast off their first faith. And besides, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but also gossipers and busybodies, saying things which they ought not. Therefore I desire that the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the house, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully." So we have this warning, and it's for younger widows on this. But is Paul only addressing this to younger widows? Or can it be applied by a little bit of common knowledge or common sense? What about the older widows or the young women or even the older women or even the men? In a perfect world, an absolutely perfect world, the older women would have taught the younger women how to avoid these situations. In Titus chapter 2, verses 3 and following, "The older women, likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed." So older women have a job to teach the younger women. In a perfect world, these younger widows wouldn't be doing that. They would have been taught better by the older women. Have you ever been aggravated by something you see, or something that you see a person do? It just aggravates you to death. If you haven't had that feeling, you're a remarkable person. I say this with a lot of assurance, just a whole lot of assurance, because we can read some in the scriptures about this aggravation, even to the point of causing grief. And the thing that popped up in my mind when I was preparing this lesson is in the case of Korah, when Moses was with the children of Israel and they were leading them out of through from Egypt on into the Promised Land, and they're out there camped, and Korah has come to we find this over in Numbers chapter 16. If you want to look at it, it's quite a lengthy reading in it. I'm just going to use part of it. 16 verses 1 and following. "It's now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abram, the son of Eliab, and On, the son of Pelah, sons of Reuben, took men." They took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and they said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy." All the people there of God were holy. every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? Well, when Moses heard this, he just fell on his face. He went to the Lord, find out what he must do on this, and the Lord told him what he would do. And so as the punishment was fixing to be handed out, Moses said that if it's for you, we'll do this. If not, the ground is going to open up and swallow you up on this. And so there was surely some aggravation on this part. They had 250 members of the congregation, leaders, men of renown, talking against Moses and Aaron. It was no small thing. But it turned out they were very small when compared to the will of the Lord. For they were swallowed up by the earth and destroyed. And not only these 250 men, but also their families, their children, all their household goods, everything that they had was swallowed up the earth and all of their possessions. And thus, it was proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that Moses was the approved leader, and this was no small thing, although these small men had made it a point to try to come before and between God and the children of Israel. Well, has this, if you've been aggravated, has this aggravation caused you to having something against this person? Has it caused you to go to this brother or to this sister and tell them this so that the Bible tells us that we should first go to our brother and sister if they've caused some problems on this. We find this over in Matthew chapter 18, and beginning with verse 14 or 15 in there on this. And let's read this, and it says, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector." Let's be careful. Let's be careful. Let's look at what he said. The scripture says, if your brother sins against you, not aggravates you, but sins against you. Is something that aggravates, is it a sin? Well, maybe you're just narrow-minded. There are some things that can be really aggravating, and yet they're not sin. For example, when I retired, I fully retired, I quit shaving every day. And sometimes it gets a little bit scroungy looking with my whiskers out there, and it may be aggravating to somebody, but you ought to shave. You look like a bum. Well, that's part of the joys of being completely retired and you're not going anywhere to do anything. Just let your whiskers grow. You don't have to wrestle with that razor and shave your face or run a lawnmower across it and all. But it's some person, it may be evil, or it may be look bad. But if it's an aggravation to them, and they go tell somebody else, and they're talking to somebody else, you know, this old Bob, he's always looks like a bum. Maybe we ought to say something to him. But you're talking among yourselves. And he says, but you may say, well, it caused me to have evil thoughts when we talk about it. Hey, all those whiskers all over his thoughts made me have evil thoughts. Maybe you think about him as a bum, not as a nice person and all. Well, cause you to have evil thoughts. Maybe your thoughts are evil and the sin lies at your doorstep. You're just thinking evil thoughts about something that has no concern of yours. Well, it's offensive to me. It's offensive to me. If it's offensive, let's be careful here again. Do we have any examples in the scriptures of being offensive and how it may affect your brother? Let's look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 1. It's now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or earth, as there are many gods and many idols, yet for us as Christians, there is one God, the Father of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have all things, and through him we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. Not that strong. For some, with consciousness of the idol, until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, or if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idol? And because of your knowledge shall a weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. What is this that we're to get out of this? The Apostle Paul is writing to correct a practice that is causing sin in the church at Corinth. This whole discourse that he wrote down is that he is speaking to them about that meat offered to idols is nothing. It's nothing. Don't mean anything. And some of you are knowledgeable concerning this fact, but some of them do not have this knowledge. They're not that strong. They're not that confident. And when they see the strong Christian eating this meat offered to idols, then they reason, if he can eat it, so can I. Yet their conscience is violated, and they are sinning by eating the meat offered to idols. They have a weak conscience, and they're not convinced that this is not something for idols and that. And so they have sinned. The point that we need to learn from this is that a strong Christian can do something in itself that's not a matter of faith, it's not a matter of whether it's going to send you to torment or not. Yet it causes a weak brother to sin by seeing that which they see a strong brother do. Then the weak brother sins. But what if a weak brother is aggravated and offended, but does not do what the offensive or aggravation is aggravating to them? It's offensive or it's aggravating to them, but they don't do it. It didn't cause them to do it. Has a strong brother caused a weak brother to sin? I think not. Or is a weak brother just raising a fuss to get something started, and if they continue, so discard in the brotherhood? Possibly, the offended, when they talk about this to other members of the body here, is showing their small talk. Oh, we might put it another way. They're showing their smallness by talking when they should get over it. In James chapter 3, beginning at verse 6, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. I've left some of the verses out of this on this in order to make it shorter. Verse 8, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Verse 10, out of the same mouth proceeds blessings and cursings. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. This is a lesson, just another lesson for all of us to try to keep control of that small and little member in our body, the tongue. Many lessons have been brought to God's people about this small talk, which, if we're not constantly on guard, we can get caught up in it ourselves and be guilty of this idle talk, gossip. And you may have heard many lessons on the same subject, and one delivering it, I entitled it, and they would have entitled it gossiping. People don't like the term gossip or gossiping, so maybe if I use the term small talk, I won't be run out of town. All of this has been a lesson to help me, possibly yourself, from talking into or falling into one of Satan's most favorite traps, and that is small talk or tale-bearing. This is one of the things when I was preparing to get a lesson together that I said, well, it's a difficult thing to bring a lesson to a congregation. And what lesson do I need? What lesson can I talk about that I need that is sorely lacking in my part that I can admonish myself and share it with you? It is awful easy to say something that is aggravating or talk about something that's aggravating that you see somebody do, and yet it is nothing that's sinful, but it's aggravating. And when you start talking about it to somebody else and become wagging your tongue and doing that and not saying something that's worthwhile, then it drags you down and you have evil thoughts and sinful. Even you can say something good. If you can't say something good, don't say anything at all, is one way of looking at it. A lady one time was asked, she was always having good words about everybody. She never had a bad word about anybody. And a smart young fellow said, I bet you I know one that you, person that you can't say anything good about. She says, what's that? He says, the devil. And she says, he's always busy. So let's not give the devil an opportunity. The lesson is yours as we stand and as we sing our song of invitation.